As a physician, caregiving can expose the gaps in care our patients receive. Here's what one physician mom caring for her son with mitochondrial disease, who received a heart transplant during COVID, learned on the other side of the stethoscope and how it made her a better physician. Dr. Heather Gatcombe is a radiation oncologist at Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University and an assistant professor at Emory University School of Medicine. She's also the mother of a child with mitochondrial disease leading to heart failure and transplant. She serves on the board of trustees of the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, as well as the UMDF Scientific and Medical Advisory Board, Clinical Training and Education Committee. As a physician and a parent, she's dedicated to improving clinician awareness, shortening diagnostic delays, and advocating for patients and families affected by mitochondrial disease. You're listening to Succeed in Medicine, the show for practicing physicians who want to master the parts of their career and life that med school never prepared us for. From interpersonal skills to career navigation to the essential information every physician needs. I'm Dr. Bradley Block, and in every episode, we bring you brass tacks advice and immediately applicable insights from world-class experts so you can feel prepared wherever your MD takes you and build a life in medicine that's sustainable, rewarding, and actually worth all those years of sacrifice. Dr. Heather Gatcombe, welcome back to the podcast.
Brad, thank you so much for having me again. It's great to see you.
You as well. So let's get right into it. You know, when we spoke last time, we were talking about mitochondrial disease, and we spoke about your son's story with having mitochondrial disease. So the last time was more of a things that physicians should know so they can recognize it when they see it, don't lead to diagnostic delays, which can happen very commonly. And so for those listeners, if you haven't heard it, definitely go back and check out this episode. In being a caregiver for someone with a complex illness, it must have been very informative for you being a physician, right? Informed how you now interface with the healthcare system from the physicians.
Definitely. As you know, it's very different being a patient or having a close family member going through the medical system. Stressful. Even when you have clinical knowledge, it can be very frustrating and difficult getting the services you need. So our son actually developed heart failure when he was 11 and had a prolonged hospital stay. And when he was discharged, he really should have gone to inpatient rehab, but he was sent home because he had an LVAD and they didn't know how to manage it in a rehab facility.
So what you're saying is that he was too complicated for inpatient rehab, so they sent him home.
That is what happened at that time. This was 2021 in the middle of COVID. There was not a pediatric rehab facility in our area that would take him because he had an LVAD. Yeah. So instead, they trained us, his two doctor parents, but my husband and I are both clinicians, and we struggled to take care of him at home. We did not have the support services we needed. He had two feedings. We were trying to manage that. He was throwing up from the bolus feedings. We didn't have home health. We didn't have a wheelchair. We didn't have a shower chair. It was very difficult for two physicians with medical connections and a background. So I can't imagine what it's like for people who don't have that network.
Yeah. I mean, I've said that recently. My dad's been having an illness, and we've been using the hospital system where my sister-in-law is the program director of the internal medicine program, and she is very well connected. So he's been getting fantastic care, but there are all these like communication things. And so having a physician's son, a program director's sister-in-law, like he's getting taken care of. But had we not been in these positions, the care wouldn't have been the same.
Yeah.
And so we keep on saying to each other, how do people do it that don't have these backgrounds? And it's unfortunate. But I don't want to get into all the issues that we have with our healthcare system, because this podcast is more for like physicians to help us be better, not to move the mountain that is the healthcare system. We've got advocacy programs and things for that. And I think we should take a step back first, because what I want to really get into is how you've become a better clinician through your experience, right? How you interact with your patients differently and what you would want differently from your physicians. But let's start with the story. For those who may have missed the last episode, just give us the brief version of how he arrived at his diagnosis of mitochondrial disease and then get into the story of his heart failure. So let's start there.
So my son is in high school now, but when he was younger, when he was 7, he started having these episodes where he would develop weakness on half of his body. He would lose the ability to speak, and he was eventually diagnosed with metabolic strokes due to suspected mitochondrial disease. But it took 5 years before we had a definitive diagnosis of why this was happening. 3 years in, he had a muscle biopsy that confirmed mitochondrial depletion and dysfunction, but we still didn't have genetic cause confirming mitochondrial disease. We had an amazing geneticist who advocated for us. She was actually the fellow when my son first had symptoms when he was 7. And after we were about 3 years in and we had the muscle biopsy, she actually reached out and shared his story with specialists up at CHOP. So they were very interested in seeing him. They were very suspicious that this was mitochondrial disease. And that was a game changer in terms of his care. We found this amazing multidisciplinary team. My son was able to be part of research trials to help other kids in the future. They eventually found a variant of unknown significance, which means there was a mutation, but they didn't know if it caused disease or not. Yeah. And it was 1 year later where there was a publication of other patients who had that mutation with similar symptoms that proved that was a pathogenic mutation, that he did have mitochondrial disease. So even with a team of experts suspecting mitochondrial disease on day one, it took us 5 years till we had a true diagnosis.
And if I remember correctly, when he was having the metabolic strokes, the neurologist that was seeing him was like one of your closest friends.
It was. He still is one of our closest friends, despite having to give us that information.
I mean, it really helps to have that type of relationship, but often that's not the case. And so it sounds like he very rapidly got this suspicion for mitochondrial disease. They didn't have a definitive answer because his specific chromosomal abnormality hadn't even been identified as one that causes mitochondrial disease. So it's not like there could have been more that they could have done, correct?
Yes. At that time, mitochondrial disease is still in its infancy. We've only known about mitochondrial diseases for about the past 3 decades. And we've only had access to rapid genetic testing for the past 15 years or so. So the science is still catching up. Scientists are finding new mutations every few months. And it can be very frustrating for patients with a rare genetic disease because we really need the science and literature to catch up. And that's why for these rare disease patients, it's so important for us to share our stories, to publish case series, for patients to get involved on registries so we can collect data and help future patients.
So what would you want physicians to know who are helping families navigate an elusive diagnosis, right? Where we're not totally sure of what's going on. So you're speaking to a bunch of physicians who have patients in a similar situation where they think they know what's going on, but they're not quite sure to where to take the workup. That nebulousness, how do we help our patients navigate that? What do they need to hear from us that we might not be telling them?
First, you want to start with honest communication of what you know so far, but also helping to guide them for support for whatever they need, whether that's a second opinion at another institution, whether that's guiding them to support service such as patient groups where they can find a community, where they realize they're not alone and where they can have access to patient education and also have access to possible clinical trials in the future. Especially for mitochondrial disease, I guide patients to MitoAction and the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation because they'll help patients even with suspected disease. You don't have to have a genetic diagnosis to receive support from them.
Yeah. Well, I guess they know, right? Like in your situation, there are mutations that just haven't been discovered yet that are affecting, that do cause mitochondrial disease.
Exactly.
Yeah. Has there been any change to how you communicate uncertainty with your patients based on this experience?
Definitely. I feel, especially as an oncologist, we deal with uncertainty a lot. When I first see patients, perhaps their staging isn't back or their pathology isn't back. And all we can offer is honest communication of what we know so far. It's scary and frustrating being in that seat. I try to offer patients what I would want offered to my family members, whether that's support service or basically guidance of how I would want to be guided through that journey. And that's unique for every patient based on what their diagnosis is or suspected to be.
Okay. So try to envision the patient as a loved one, family member, themselves.
And how would you want your grandma treated?
Yeah. Let's say maybe we reassured a patient inappropriate, right? Mm. This seems like it's something self-limited. This seems like it's not part of a bigger picture. This seems like something that's not concerning. Let's follow up, or let's not. Just let me know if your symptoms persist. So you're not dismissing it per se, but at the same time, it's not leading to a greater workup yet. So that's what happened. And then, as it turns out, it was part of a bigger problem. Do you think there's an opportunity to repair that relationship?
I think that depends on the relationship you have. Every patient wants to be heard. So I think if they felt dismissed, how would you feel in that situation? But I think as long as you're honest and communicating, you can only do based on the knowledge you have currently. If you were suspicious and there was a red herring, I mean, you're human. That's my take on that.
If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the other shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Doctors Making a Difference. Be inspired by Dr. Peter Crane of Doctors Making a Difference. Discover stories of physicians who are transforming lives and communities. Celebrate the impact of medicine beyond the clinic. Listen and subscribe to be part of the movement. This is from Danielle Ofri, who wrote many books, one of which is on medical mistakes. And it's, patients are okay with us not being perfect, as long as it's not with them. And so, as you wear both hats, let's say somewhat you were in a situation where the physician maybe minimized something that was going on, and then later it became an issue. What would you want to hear from that physician?
So I have been in situations like that with my child. You know, having a child with mitochondrial disease, it can affect any organ. So we were seeing cardiology and the whole team. So he had an EKG where they saw something, but they thought, oh, it could be a normal pediatric variant. So they ordered an echo. It was fine. They ordered a Holter monitor. And then 3 months later, he went into sudden heart failure. It's not their fault per se, but it was so frustrating and disappointing. And we never heard from that doctor again. So that was a little disappointing.
So what you're saying is that doctor should have reached out and said, like, I'm so sorry this happened to you. What could they have done to repair?
This is someone who is out of state. So it's different than an intimate relationship you have with someone you're seeing regularly. But yes.
So they might not have even been made aware of this change in status.
Possibly. They should have, but yes.
Okay.
The second instance was after my son had his transplant. He was doing great. He was transferred from the cardiac ICU to the regular floor after 4 days, but he wasn't eating much. And in our last talk, we reviewed how patients with mitochondrial disease cannot fast because it can put them at risk for a metabolic crisis. And so he actually asked the team, he was 12 at the time, for a feeding tube because he wasn't feeling great. And he had a feeding tube while he had his LVAD waiting for a transplant. And the team just kind of looked at us funny. It was a weekend, so who's ever rounding? And they just kind of looked at us funny. And they're like, well, we'll go talk to the on-call doctor. And I really wished I had pushed harder for that, because within an hour, he lost the ability to speak again. He had another metabolic stroke. And after that instance, I will never ignore my gut. If I ever have a concern like that, I am going to fight for my kid because he knows what he needs. He knows his body. I mean, Every parent is an expert in their kid. So that's the regret I have on me. But that's one time where we didn't feel listened to at that time. And I'm still a little disappointed.
Yeah. Five years later, Still a little disappointed. So take us through more of his transplant journey.
Yeah. So when he was 11, he developed sudden heart failure. We didn't know what was happening at the time because we had a negative cardiac workup and we were told all is good. But he was getting a bit more tired, and then he started having viral symptoms. So everyone thought he had a GI virus. He was nauseous. He had an upset stomach. This was in 2021, so everyone assumed it was COVID. It was hard to get a PCR test at that time. So my husband brought him to the ER thinking, oh, he just needs fluids. We'll get a PCR test. We'll figure out what's going on. I had a baby at the time off at daycare, and he called and said, our son's in heart failure. He's being admitted urgently to the cardiac ICU. As I said before, we're both doctors. Neither of us caught this. It caught us off guard. At that time, all of our visits were virtual. So no one listened to his heart. They were video visits. We were telling him that, you know, he's nauseous. There was one other side effect in retrospect. He had throat clearing. He kept clearing his throat, which apparently means as a sign of heart failure, which I do not recall from medical school. Apparently, from your facial experience, you don't remember that from med school either.
From med school, I'm an ear, nose, and throat doctor. I see throat clearing all the time. And maybe it should be on my differential for
now.
For
it will
clearing.
Be.
But like, we see it sometimes from asthma because this viscous secretions start in the lungs and then make it up to the trachea. You don't really feel it until it gets to the trachea. And so then you clear your throat. I guess the grunting that you need to do to keep your, I'm not really understanding the physiology of where
it's
the throat
clearing comes. It's because increasing the pressure for when you have pulmonary hypertension.
Yeah.
This is outside my realm of knowledge. My husband's a psychiatrist. A he thought he had Tourette's.
Throat clearing's like PEEP. I guess that's kind of how I understand it in the setting of heart failure, but not understanding all that physiology. Okay. So we're not going to turn this into the throat clearing post nasal drip talk. Okay, so he was having some throat clearing, and as it turns out, that was this really lesser-known symptom of heart failure. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
So he was admitted to the ICU, and he just deteriorated within a few hours. He developed increased facial swelling. At a point, my husband stopped me. I had gone home to put our baby to bed, and my husband called and said, you have to get back here right now. The doctor actually took him aside and said, I see three heart rhythms incompatible with life. If we don't put him on ECMO now, we may be coding him in the middle of the night. So I rushed back there. They placed him on ECMO. He actually developed internal bleeding from being on the ECMO because you're in so many blood thinners.
You're coagulated, yeah.
They had to take him off the ECMO. He was able to get it through the weekend, and they were able to place an LVAD. He had multi-organ dysfunction and failure at that time, but the LVAD actually helped improve systemically.
Okay.
6 weeks later, he was healthy enough to be listed on the transplant list. He was discharged home with the LVAD. One of us always had to be with him because, do you have experience with LVADs at all? I did not.
Okay. None.
So there's a drive line coming out of the abdomen that connects to a machine that has two batteries that are keeping the system going. And so you always have to maintain the system. If you hear an alarm, they basically trained us what to do if there's an emergency, to swap things out. But it was terrifying. Like if this device did not work properly, we could lose our son. So
yeah.
Luckily, we live 15 minutes from the hospital. So we're very lucky about that. So one of us always had to be with him. Someone had to sleep with him in case the alarm went off.
Yeah.
He was on the transplant list for 4 months. He actually got kicked off for a month because he caught COVID. And this was 2021. Oh. They didn't know what that meant.
Yeah, that must have been terrifying
that
in and of itself.
That was terrifying. In retrospect, was that bad or good? I don't know. It gave him time to gain weight. He had a feeding tube at the time. We were doing physical therapy twice a week. So actually, when he received his transplant, he was in optimal health. He had gained weight because he had developed so much muscle atrophy and malnutrition from that hospital stay. He was so cachectic. He was so emaciated. It was terrifying and it was really hard to manage. And I'm glad that part of her life is over. And I don't want anyone to go through that again.
So if there's a takeaway that you would want physicians to know based on that experience, right? Because I'm sure you had some amazing interactions and this heroic team that was able to do all of this for him, but nobody bats 1,000. And so is there anything that you would want physicians to know that you learned from that experience that can help us treat our patients better in the future?
The most important thing would be making sure that your patients have the support services they need. Especially when we left the hospital, we were not prepared.
Yeah.
Whether that's setting up home health or having a dietitian to call if you need to manage tube feeds, ideally a nurse navigator would be amazing. We have that in oncology. I wish we had the bandwidth to expand that to other medical subfields because having more support during that time would have been a game changer. We were trying to figure it out as we went along.
And two extremely capable individuals with background knowledge in this area. Like imagine this was two people who were school teachers, right? Police officers. Some, they worked at a deli. You're two physician couple who are connected to other physicians in other fields, right? So you had all the resources at your disposal, and yet you don't feel like you were equipped well enough. You know, I think when we're discharging patients, like a lot of time, I just remember being an intern and discharging people, and you're like, your job is to get them discharged, right? Finish up all their paperwork, make sure everything's tucked, and then get them out the door, not making sure that everything is taken care of for them when they get home. You know, we talk about the transitions being the handoffs, being the most dangerous times for physicians, for patients, right? You're leaving your shift as a hospitalist and signing out your patients to another shift, to another hospitalist. That's a critical juncture. But the discharge from the hospital to a SNF, to home, in particular, making sure that everything is tucked there when they get home, and they have all the support services they need. That's an excellent point, making sure that is taken care of.
Yeah, because for a patient, it's almost impossible to figure out those resources once you've left the hospital. So making sure social workers seeing them and that they have the appropriate referrals before they leave.
Yeah. Anything else? Any other big lessons from this entire journey that you had of taking care of your son with mitochondrial disease, his transplant journey, or your journey as a family? Before we wrap up, one last pointer or fact or something for our physicians so that we can do a better job and learn from your experience.
Yeah, I think honest communication and being curious is very important. So that one geneticist who was a fellow who referred us to CHOP, she's also publishing a case series with our son's rare mutation. She just called me a few weeks ago. They found three other patients with the same mutation with similar backgrounds, and they found that three out of those four have had heart transplants.
Wow.
It's eye-opening. I started tearing up because that means the next patients that have to go through this, their families are going to get the resources they need. They're going to follow closely with cardiology. They're going to be monitored so closely. There's new medications now that weren't available then, like alimipratide, which has been shown to help in mitochondrial-induced heart failure. And hopefully those patients won't need a transplant. Science is progressing.
Yes. So I think the big takeaways were full transparency when you're communicating, right? So communicate that uncertainty and be transparent about it and be clear about it with your communication. Be curious about what you know, about what you think you know and what you don't know, because you never know who you're going to help down the road, like in your situation. And then make sure that your patients are prepared upon discharge for any potential eventualities. Make sure that their home care is as tucked as possible with everything they might need. Because, I mean, I just can't believe it still. Like, saying, well, they wouldn't take care of him because he had an LVAD, so they sent us home with an LVAD. I just can't make that make sense.
I will say for patients whose parents are not doctors, most of them do stay in the hospital. But because we had medical training, they let him come home. And ultimately, it allowed him to heal a bit better. He was at his home environment. He slept much better. Yeah. We all slept a lot better.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay. So that's not less of a judgment of that decision maker. It was more because
it's a perk of being a doctor.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's a feature, not a bug. Well, first, thank you to him for allowing you to share his story, because I know that this took his permission to be able to come out here on my show, on other podcasts, to be able to share his story. And thank you for being so transparent about this, going through this again and again. That was just such a painful experience for you, and being so forthcoming about it. And thank you for sharing your story with us.
Brad, it was a pleasure. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means either you fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please write us a 5-star review, take a screenshot, and email it to me so I can send you a quick guide on how to earn patient trust in 20 seconds or less. Email me at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and feel free to suggest a topic or guest. I take your requests seriously. The views expressed on this episode are those of the interviewer and the interviewee and do not represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting makes it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or legal advice or really any advice. Thanks again for listening to Succeed in Medicine.